All right, everybody, welcome back to Hogcast, the official podcast of the 442nd Fighter Wing. I'm Bob Jennings, the Superintendent of Public Affairs, and I'm here with Colonel Mike Rio Leonis, the Wing Commander, and Chief Master Sergeant Nate Parks, the Command Chief, who is also going to be our interviewee for this week.
That was a great honor. That was fun. That was good sitting down and getting to chat a little bit.
Yeah, awesome. This is something we're going to try to change and put this before the UTA so that people can drive in or commute in or preview what's going on prior. And I think that's a good change, Chief, and your interview was awesome. Good stuff. Hey, Babbel time. We're up to $200 for those individuals that are going to try to guess what Babbel time is named after. The first hint was Davis Mothen. The second hint was Bulldogs, which is a squadron at Davis Mothen that just closed down 2 weeks ago at Hogsmoke. It was a pretty sad ceremony, is the best way to describe it. And then hint for this week is tactical. So the hints of why it's called Babbel time is Davis Mothen, Bulldogs, tactical. Chief, we have some hardship going on in our wing. The hurricane went through and basically dumped and hit Valdosta straight on. And there's people, we're talking day six.
Yeah.
We're on Wednesday, day six of the hurricane recovery, and there's people without power, and there's people without running water, and the base is a mess. That whole area is a mess. We've been talking about this to Colonel Waring, and he's doing a great job with his team.
No surprise, the team steps up down there. We got reservists coming out of the woodwork, helping out. They're driving forklifts. They're doing everything they can to help out. And so that's no surprise. I've always said it's great to be a part of a unit that we have great people that just happen to be airmen. And when a crisis like that goes down, those are just great people out there.
Yep. We got Slobo, a member who came out of here driving a forklift. He looked more at home driving the forklift than a Delta uniform, in my opinion. Sorry, Slobo, but you looked at ease there. And again, multi-capable airmen or multi-ready airmen doing stuff in the community and the base as it recovers. Pretty significant damage down there. And we're looking out for you guys. We care about what's going on. As Colonel Waring is running a great show down there. So for sure. But huge thing that's affecting our wing and not at Missouri. Other things, obviously, we're wrapping up our ACS deployers. The majority of them are out the door, but they went to the Hive. And we'll talk about later how active the Hive is in our what's unstable in the world today. But we have people that are deploying right in there, and they're all ready, and they all deployed, and we all got everybody out ready now, as I expected the swing. And then the aviation package is going to start their training pre-certification phase, and that's going to happen here quickly rather than short. I want to throw props to our people that did the fiscal execution and the flying hour program close out. The only word I can say is very well done. Best ever, I would say, that we've seen, at least what our financial manager team says. And you know how hard that is, and you know how that's important, Chief. Specifically being up the Pentagon and hearing them chirp about that all the time.
Yeah, great job out there. And it sucks sometimes listen to us rant and rave about get your travel vouchers in, get your order on the ooze and goos. And we talk about at staff meetings and everything else. That sucks at times, but that's what General Healy refers to as the systematic dismantling of the reserve is when we give back money. And we can effectively say that we didn't give back money.
Exactly. And I talked about the team. Quite honestly, the team is everybody. Because it starts with the youngest airman filing their travel voucher.
Absolutely.
All the way up to you and I emphasizing how important it is and how our commanders are telling us how important it is. So incredible job when the financial execution for the whole wing and the flying hour program. I think we flew the most hours in Air Force Reserve Command if you add the active duty side, which is phenomenal. It, as a minimum, we're the most in the combat air forces. Maybe an RTU beat us up, but we'll validate that. But just phenomenally well done. And I can't be more proud of the wing for those executions. So financial, mission, we're just crushing it.
Yeah,
so
financially, $1 at a time and hourly, it's one hour sorties, 2 hour sorties at a time.
Yeah.
Just really just executed to
executed
very,
very
efficiently.
Well by not just one, but by all. So phenomenal, proud of the team. Extremely well done. What do we got going on this UTA? There's a lot of other things we're not going to talk about that are going on, and make sure that you pass that on or dig that out from your UTA pre-briefs and stuff. But we got a Warthog University. Chief, you're going to run that, I believe.
Yeah, we're going to sit down and do some chatting and just talk through some things and see what's on your mind and see how I can and the team of chiefs can serve you better here at Whiteman and just have a discussion.
Yep, and that'll be on Saturday. And then also on Saturday, we're having another 442nd Fighter Wing social sponsored by the Chiefs Group. It will be at a location that you can get from your supervisor, and that starts after drill on Saturday.
Absolutely.
And that's a great, you haven't seen, you actually did see one when
I
you were
come out.
Coming out before you actually went on orders with us. And it's just a great way to network and not just be in your pod, in your squadron, but actually see there's other people and other professionals in our wing.
We get so much out of these conversations, whether it's a Warthog University or it's the Sapper Suicide Awareness Training where you talk about it, or top three meetings, or no matter what it is, this social also is.
Yep.
We get so much out of these conversations, learning about each other, building that family network. But please go out and enjoy some food and some drinks, if you will, but let's have a plan.
Yep. And sponsored by the Chiefs. Yep. It's not just the Chiefs. There was some confusion in the past on that. I like to see the youngest airmen out there, and we'll emphasize that at the pre-ETA, and your supervisors will tell you when that's at. Sunday, we got a couple of competitions and a crew chief ceremony. So we have a maintenance load competition. We're going to see the best loaders in Air Force Reserve Command, probably in the Air Force there, per what happened at Davis-Monthan during Hog Smoke. It was awesome. The finals were the 476 load team and the 442nd load team, and they went head-to-head. The 476 won. And so the 442nd came in second. What I didn't know at that competition is that the Lobos came in third. Of all the A-10 load teams nationwide or worldwide, we went 1, 2, 3. Yeah. Phenomenal.
Not surprised.
I'm not surprised either, but that's huge.
Yeah.
And to hit that achievement in the heat, and it was a coordinated precision, it was art. And I was super proud. I was able to give the trophy, Colonel Riddle, even though he sponsored Hog Spoke, gave me the mic and made sure I got to present the awards. But 1, 2, and 3, that's phenomenal. We're going to prop those guys during the pre-UTA because it's just awesome. Anyway, so we're going to have a load competition on the flight line.
So a little embarrassing to say, but this will be my first time ever watching a load competition. Never been to one. And I'm looking forward to that, as well as the dedicated crew chief ceremony.
Yep, dedicated crew chief ceremony is awesome as well. And that's a tradition we reinvigorated over the last couple of years. And it's just great. And to give them the recognition they deserve, obviously, as a pilot, I appreciate them. But quite honestly, who appreciates them more is my family.
Yeah.
And what they do for our unit in regards to the aircraft, we're bragging about our FMC rate. That's not the good all, but we were at 91%.
This is
phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's unheard of. And we've been leading even when we're not at the 90s. For all the Air Force, probably all of the Air Force, not just Air Force Reserve Command. And it's just the culture and the expertise of the dedicated crew chiefs and the entire maintenance team out there working on the airplane. Super proud, and we'll be able to celebrate that job. And then, awesome, Sunday, big day, family day. It's going to be the second half of the Sunday drill, and we will, it's the same as last year and same as your report. Every year that's gotten better. And we want everybody to come out there. The weather's going to be awesome. It's not going to be too cold like last year.
Yeah, I think I'm starting in the dunk tank.
Are you?
So, I'm planning on heckling a lot of people.
Okay.
And all the bad throwers.
Yeah, I think
there.
I'm going last. Hopefully everybody will leave early. So I won't be a dunk tank. But I will cheer on everybody throwing at Chief there. But so that's a huge family, obviously family day. But it brings our whole wing together. And you get to see not just the airmen in uniform, but the people that helped them get out the door to drill and stuff like that. And it's a great event, and it's gotten better and better every day. We got a perfect model of how to make that right.
Yeah, I think that leads right into the deoxes out there talking about getting better and better. We don't get better. We don't really fully know how these family day picnics create in culture in the squadrons or what you're facing unless you get out and you do this deox. We've tried to make it as easy as possible. There's little scan codes everywhere, a little click. I think it's going to take you probably 7 minutes to fill out the whole thing. But please take the time. We want to hear from you. Again, it's usually something crazy, like 15 to 20% of a wing that actually does these. We would love to see 60, 70, 80.
Yeah, we're already a wing. We're already above call it the common standard. But I want that percentage that you just stated.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We want you to know that you have a voice, and this is your wing that we get the privilege of leading, and really get out and let your voice be heard and give us some honesty.
I want the bad.
Yeah.
And I'd like the good too.
The good stuff. What's keeping you here and what would drive you?
Yeah, in? Because if you tell us the good stuff, we'll make it better.
Yep.
And if you tell the bad stuff, we'll address it. So definitely the deox is hot through November, but the more we get at each UTA, the better we chip away at that. We got some wing positions that we hired. We hired an AGR in the IG, Master Sergeant Bellis from the Surety Forces.
You're in the interviews.
Quite a few applicants.
Yeah.
If I heard her.
So I think 13 total applicants.
Wow.
Yeah. And just phenomenal applicants. I've had the honor of sitting in on, I think, 6 interviews now since I've been here in a short amount of time. And Fitz, every shop out there just has some phenomenal individuals in there that just love hearing their story, love hearing their leadership. And we're going to find places for them throughout the wings. If you get told no at one thing, don't think that's a no. That may just be that one position.
Yep. And we filled the tap coordinator.
Absolutely.
With Master Sergeant Green.
Tech Sergeant Green.
I promoted her.
Yeah. Not yet. Let's hold back.
Yeah. That's a surprise that we're holding back.
Yeah.
And then we also filled the yellow ribbon with Huff.
Master Sergeant Huff.
And he comes out from AFE. So those are two positions that we filled, as well as the AGR. And then we're collecting resumes and packages for the DNTF coordinator. Sergeant Sanchez had to leave that position, so that kind of opened up surprise.
Yeah, she's done a great job leading that, and she's going to step away. But what a great opportunity someone has to step up. If you don't know, the DNTF coordinator is the development and training flight. So these are the pre-going to basic training. You get to impact and imprint airmen before they're airmen. They're pre-airmen at this point.
Yeah.
And just what a great job. So we want all of the best out there to come in and really let's put our best foot forward. Let's put our best people in front of those airmen to where their entire career, they'll look at those people and see that's the standard.
Yep. Centrally funded full-time orders.
Yes,
so it's a great opportunity. And you have great ideas of how you're going to make
that.
They
will be highly involved with the wing.
Perfect. And I love where you're running with that. And then again, we got a couple more IG positions coming up. I can't really talk about the exact dates, but looks like we'll have a GS 11 or 12. A new position, get certified. We'll probably announce that opportunity in November and then perhaps another position later on. So great opportunities for full-time jobs in the wing. That's what's going on. This UTA, we talked about all the changes going on in the Air Force and you said, oh, this will change as soon as we have a war.
Yeah.
And that was Tuesday around 10 o'clock. Yeah. And then Tuesday at 11, I get a text that Israel's getting rocketed, missile attacked from Iran. So huge event in regards to international security and stability. They launched 200 missiles, and I don't think they caused any or many casualties, but just that volume of an attack from Iran to Israel, it's overflying where we have people. And that's significant. That's the hive. The hive's not getting any better over there. Israel obviously stimulated this attack with their pagers, their handheld radios, and then they killed a significant number of Hezbollah leadership with strikes into Lebanon. So these are things that are just absolutely this month.
Yeah, and I think sometimes when you come out here and you do your job on the UTAs and you've got a job back home, maybe a school teacher or whatever it may be, you're like, hey, why do I care? Like, why do I care that Israel and them? And I will tell you that we're already involved with this. I read this morning where it was some Navy ships that intercepted some of the missiles that were headed.
Oh, no kidding.
And then we've got some airplanes that have been involved with.
Yeah, absolutely. The drone attack, 100%.
Yeah. So we're already involved with this. And I think it's up to us to really put that why in, why we're out here and why we're training, why we preach readiness, why we preach spending our money, why we preach these things. But we really need to really link the mission to what we're doing out here.
Absolutely. The majority of our ACS package deployers that are out the door or going out the door went to that area of operation, CENTCOM, and our aviation package is slotted to go there as well. I heard this might not be exactly 40. The U.S. has 40,000 troops still over there.
Yeah.
We're highly involved, like you said, and the Houthi rebels are still misbehaving as well. And airplanes, Air Force airplanes are supporting these engagements and stuff like that. You cannot mitigate what's going on in the world this week. And it was last month, the previous month. It's been rough.
Yeah. So you got to be ready.
Yep. I think the biggest thing that happened to the wing this month was Chief and I went to two engagements. The first one was the CSAF, Chief Staff of the Air Force's Commanders Conference in D.C. It was a great venue. And he's talked specifically about the buyback of aircraft, specifically driven by the Senate. And he talked about F-15Es, which was interesting because just today, Chief and I went to a breakfast meeting with two senators. One was Senator Schmidt from Missouri, first term senator. It seemed like a very engaged, very energetic senator.
He cared about the airmen, cared about the mission here.
He did. And then he invited Senator Wicker, who is, I'll call him a more senior statesman from the state of Mississippi. And he is actually the minority leader on the Senate Armed Services Committee. So he invited Senator Wicker, specifically to talk about white men. And quite honestly, we had the two other wing commanders, the bomb wing, 509th and the 131st bomb wing commanders, but the meeting was about us.
It was.
And
from the very get-go.
From the get-go. They said, go. And we were able to talk about us. And I was very clear. I'd been pre-briefed what I could say.
Yeah, and I think sometimes that gets lost is we went through a lot of preparation, talked to a lot of different people of the do's and don'ts. And so this isn't something that we just willy-nilly said, hey, you guys want to have breakfast? This was coordinated through the chain. We continually get coached up. We learn from last engagements. We learn from this engagement. Mm-hmm. We'll learn. We keep moving forward. But yeah, what a great conversation.
It was.
What a
was
great
awesome.
Opportunity for us to brag on our airmen.
Yes.
What they're capable of, what this wing has done. Felser, you represented this
Thanks.
Wing very well at that table. They kept asking for more. You give them information. They were asking for more information. Hey, tell us about the errand. Tell us about how you could do this mission. What if we did this? How would you do this mission? And at the end of it all, you were just like, hey, we're Air Force members and we're going to do exactly what the Air Force does.
Absolutely. I can't.
But it was like fighter follow on. We'd love one.
I didn't hold back on the fact of who we are. Mm-hmm. I said we're the most experienced spider wing out there. And I talked about it being unfair. A-10s, Afghanistan, global war and terror. The same people have deployed over and over again. I can't imagine any fighter wing having more experience
right.
than us. And then I talked about the timing. And Senator Wicker, so you got about a year. I said, yeah, maybe a couple months more than a year and before we have attrition. So they are 100% aware of who we are. Mm-hmm. They're 100% aware of the timing. And I would say they are aware that the fastest path to readiness would be a fighter recap.
Yeah.
And we didn't suggest this, but the senator from Missouri talked about F-15s. Yeah. And I think F-15Es were discussed a lot. That'd be great. And there's no final word.
Yeah.
But
little incremental things. But,
sure.
But definitely know that Weidman in 442nd is on
their minds consistently.
They're on the senators that represent us.
And the Senate Armed Services Committee. So it was an incredible engagement.
Yeah,
and
great opportunity.
It was. And that's what your leadership is doing, quite honestly, daily.
Yeah.
In regards to trying to get us a follow-on aircraft. So this wing will not attrit and be continue on with excellence that we got. That's Babble Time. $200. Guess it. The cancer are Davis Mothan, Bulldogs, Tactical. Chief, do you have any final words before we wrap this up?
Look forward to seeing you guys on the UTA.
Yep, awesome. We're going to take a break, and then we'll interview Chief Parks. Bob, what do you got? A
couple things before we go into the interview. If you want to see the full list of events this weekend with times and locations, check the Air Force Connect app. If you don't have the Air Force Connect app, download it, not while you're driving. If you're listening to this in the car on the way and you don't have your family with you, turn around and go get them because we want them here for Family Day. And there are a lot of social events happening this weekend and throughout the holidays. Number one, make sure you have a plan and make sure you have a backup plan. And if both of those fail, then huge shout out to Airmen Against Drunk Driving.
Yeah.
If your plans fail and you need a ride, all you need is one valid military ID for the entire group. And their number is 660-687-RIDE.
Yeah, awesome. I would love for everybody to put that phone number in there. But the planning starts before you get there. So don't expect yourself to go somewhere and then make a plan once you get there.
Yeah, ADD is definitely not plan A.
Check. Good data, both guys. All right. Let's take a break, then we'll do our routine.
All right, and we are back with Chief Master Sergeant Nate Parks, our new command chief. Chief, welcome back. It's good to have you home.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Hey, Chief, we've been working together, setting up for you taking over as command chief for a couple months here. But quite honestly, the last 3 weeks where you've been on board full time have been way more enlightening to me as your commander. And as you being the new command chief, you made a huge impact already. And I really appreciate that. So we're going to use this forum to get to know Chief Parks. Every time we have a personal discussion, I pull some more information from you. Humble man, you don't tell me about your background and stuff like that. And it's quite interesting. And I'd like to go all the way back to when you were a kid. And I think you made a good comment that you were bouncing around a lot as a kid. And you thought your dad was having...
Yeah, I went to 7 different schools by the time I was in 6th grade. The final one in 6th grade, going to Warsaw, showing up there. And I was looking back, I'm like, maybe my dad just had warrants that we were running from, right? So I saw that a lot when I was a police officer.
Yeah.
And just to come find out that he was a hard working man and doing construction. And we moved around a lot wherever there was work. But also my grandparents were pastors. And so a lot of times when they would start a church, my parents would become the youth pastors and they would start that up and they would start being the youth pastors until they got the program to somewhere where they can hand it off to someone, to another a youth pastor or something like that. And then I think that for me, I look at that 7 different times that I got to be the new guy, the new kid, which
just is never easy,
which is challenging, right?
And yeah, so especially those ages.
I look at that too with, so my own son right now, he's a sophomore at Oak Grove High School,
yep.
Paul, and this is his 9th school as a sophomore.
Yeah, right? That's tough.
And as a reservist, you look at that and you go, man, that's a lot. But the thing that we see is the resiliency that it builds, right? This is 9 different times he's been the new kid. And 9 different times he's had to introduce himself, 9 different times he's got to figure out which group to be a part of, 9 different times that he gets to redefine who he is. And so I think I really learned a lot from that at a young age, one, of how to talk to people,
okay,
and how to communicate with people, how to relate to people, and then also just to get comfortable with who I am.
Huh, yeah, so it's worse than a military brat.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, it sounds like you've finally settled down in Warsaw. And that's what you call home right now.
So, yeah.
Now, another thing you mentioned that, hey, we're moving with my grandparents. I know that when you go to football games, like the last one on, I think last Monday, you had family, friends, cousins,
absolutely,
and stuff like that. So maybe some of that bouncing around was to keep that nucleus together.
Yeah.
And your father was probably, he wasn't on the lam. He was actually worried about you guys and stuff. But yeah, that's very tough. I came to the reserves because I was sick of moving.
Yeah.
And I saw the impact it was having on my girls.
A lot of people do, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's important. And it is, but yeah, it probably made you tougher and such. And maybe that's why Paul is tough, right?
Yeah.
Because he bounced around so much. So anyways, ended up in Warsaw, and that's what you call home. And you had a pretty interesting high school career in regards to sports. And why don't you talk about that? Because I think it's pretty enlightening.
Yeah, it really got the privilege of being under some great coaching and some coaches that I'm still in contact with today. And played 4 sports a year. I actually did football, basketball, and then ran track and played baseball at the same time. Our football team this year, we were honored to be inducted into the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame.
That was this year.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Got to go down with some of my teammates and
awesome,
get inducted and got to actually do the Pledge of Allegiance and some stuff for that ceremony.
Awesome.
Was able to do that. But really highly successful program. I only, from the time I was in 7th grade till the time I graduated, we lost 4 football games.
Yeah, that's
my
insane.
My whole high school career.
That's crazy.
And really high percentage. And the craziest part is 2 of those were my senior year.
No kidding.
Really only 2 up to that point.
State championships,
Final 4 every year. But my sophomore year, I was part of an undefeated football team. And I credit a lot of who I am to that year. And so that year I was undersized, outside linebacker. That's about 115 pounds.
Okay. Yeah, that is undersized.
And a sophomore. It was pretty quick, but I had a coach that believed in me. And a senior went down about a week before the season started. And this coach came to me and was more or less just like, hey, this is probably the best thing because I really wanted you to be able to top tier.
No kidding.
Looking back on this, I think he was probably bluffing.
He just wanted
it. Was hopeful, right? But I started those games. And then when the senior came back, he said, hey, you haven't lost your spot. And so was able to do, we went 14-0, won a state championship.
Awesome.
But the confidence that I got that year really propelled me to believe in myself more and to really not look at the package to where, hey, here's an undersized individual.
Yeah. You believed in yourself, not the data.
Yeah.
That's incredible that one individual can give you that much confidence.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you bring that confidence today. Based on that one guy. Do you still keep in touch with that coach?
Yeah, so Coach Tony Berry was the one that did it, and we still stay in touch. And Coach Randy Morrow, who's part of the Missouri High School Hall of Fame, also for coaching, was the head coach. And he absolutely instilled a high level of expectation.
Yeah.
And I think that really set the tone for me because then Coach Tony Berry, who was the linebackers coach and running back coach, had a high level of confidence.
Yeah.
There was a high level of expectations, but then there was also a guy behind him that said, hey, man, we have confidence that you can meet those expectations.
How did you handle baseball and basketball season coming out of these winning
basketball never really had a winning season. We always said that people got their paybacks from football and basketball, right? And I wasn't really, I was a defensive player and was not. Baseball was probably my natural sport and
just
what I enjoyed.
Yeah.
So I didn't really work at it ever. There was no off season work for me.
And you were doing track at the same time.
But I played it so much as a kid. It was just enjoyable.
Yeah.
Me.
That, I agree. I love baseball, and it's one of those sports that I wish I was good at.
Yeah.
But incredible. High school football team inducted into the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame this year. Was it 1 year or is it a period of years? What was the honor?
So I think there were 6 years there.
That, gotcha.
That the winning percentage was so high that they felt like
that's awesome.
It probably wouldn't be duplicated.
You can be a lawyer. I don't know if you've seen that lawyer that walks around with the football in his hand in Kansas City and says, I got you.
Oh, no,
that's because he's a football player. So
you can be a lawyer in your
third career,
fifth career, so
whatever.
That's awesome. That must have been great memories. And again, back home, keep in touch with some of those former players.
Absolutely. Even Chad Pickens, who was one of my best friends in high school, we went on and we were partners on the police department together.
Yeah.
So we played football together and then turned around, graduated. He graduated a year ahead of me, but then
you're talking in the Kansas City Police Department. We'll get to that later. That's phenomenal alignment.
Yeah. So we literally rode together for 3 years.
Did they know that you were high school classmates?
Most people
teammates?
Didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most
Keeping
people
a secret.
Didn't.
We'll get to another secret you kept there.
Aligns like that. Like all throughout my life, I can show you where my life aligns.
That's it. Hysterical. We'll get to another trick you played on supervisors here in a little bit. We're recruited as a football player and had actually a scholarship to Pittsburgh State.
So yeah, it's weird as winning will have a weird effect on you. Is Southwest Baptist at the time hadn't won a game in I think 2 years or something like that. And the recruiting
was in Bolivar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The recruiting was pretty hard from them. And that was where my Tony Berry went.
Okay.
And so he was like, hey, you should go
come
look at this.
There.
And I'm like, they haven't won a game. No, I have not used to lose it.
Right.
It's Pittsburgh State was where my head coach was from.
Okay.
And really pursued Pittsburgh State. They pursued me a little bit. And so I had a partial scholarship to go there, signed a letter of intent to play football for him.
And but decided never did that to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting how you told me the decision. You didn't think it would be good for you to go to college and be a football team member. So made a pretty tough decision.
Yeah, I watched my parents. My parents were hardworking. I would say we were lower middle class. I don't know. My mom worked at a bank and my dad was construction. And we just watching that and then knowing that, hey, I got to figure out a way to pay for out-of-state tuition. I got to figure out a way to...
Yeah, that's right, because it's in Kansas. So.
And then I went to several of the games and the recruiting and rushing the unit, if you will. And my ultimate goal was to become a police officer.
Yeah.
That's always, I don't know why, that's always what I wanted to do. And that was my ultimate goal. And when I saw myself in college, I was afraid that I would do something to screw up my opportunity to go be a police officer.
A lot of people do.
Yeah.
A lot of people do.
And so I didn't think I would still have that option.
Huh.
And I'd always valued the military, just like I had valued the police department. I'd always valued the military. My uncle is a retired master sergeant. He was a maintenance guy and just one of my favorite people in the world, and his family, and just I saw what they got to do with the military and whatnot. And
right.
I remember going to him and saying, hey, I think I'm gonna join the Air Force. And he goes, oh, awesome.
Like, yeah.
What are you gonna go do? And I said, security force. He said, not a chance.
Okay. So being a defender.
Yeah. So he literally was like, you can go be a police officer. Your experience in the Air Force is going to
help you with that.
Regardless. Help you be a police officer, no matter what you do. Go do something else.
Okay.
Try something else. And so he literally was the one that said, hey, I was a flying crew chief on 130s.
Yeah.
You should go be air crew.
A flying crew chief or something like that.
Yeah. And so he pushed me towards the air crew thing. I've never heard of a loadmaster before in my life. And I was just like, I went to a recruiter and said, hey, my uncle said to tell you, I'm not leaving unless I could be a loadmaster.
Yeah.
And he's, okay.
That's good. Alibi to the defenders out there. Being a defender is pretty badass job, career field. And
yeah, it's one of the career fields. Yeah.
Any of the leaders come out.
I look at the missed opportunities of Raven.
But traveling around the world, I guess it makes a lot of sense. And you just got that pimp from your uncle to go as an air crew, which is phenomenal. Did you join the Air Force right out of high school?
Yeah, so graduated in May of 96, left for the military in August of 96. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, incredible. Who did you take with you?
So I actually took two people.
Okay.
You just know of one.
I just know one.
So a good friend of mine from high school, literally, we were talking one day and he goes, I have no clue what I'm going to do. I'm going to go probably work this t-shirt company like my mom and everybody else in this town does. And I go, hey, dude, just go join the Air Force. And so him and I joined the Air Force at the same time.
Same time.
And I said, all right, my uncle said, tell him that we want to be a loadmaster. So he also
said,
said, hey, I'm not leaving unless I'm loadmaster. So he got 141s, I was C5s.
That's an awesome
story.
So
we left at the same time.
Yeah.
We were on the buddy program at that time.
Okay.
You could say, hey, you could take a buddy with you to basic training.
Yeah.
So I joined the delayed enlistment, and I think I joined in April of 96. And so I go home, I tell my parents
hey,
that, you know, the whole college thing, not doing it, right? So I always say my dad high-fived me and my mom cried.
Yeah.
Right. And then I tell my brother.
He comes home and I say,
this, you have signed up with your buddy and your brother walks in the door.
My brother walks in, we talk, and he's 2 years ahead of me in college. And like a week later, he had joined the Air Force.
And like, did he talk to your uncle before?
I don't know if he did or not. So because he went in like open, whatever.
Oh, so right? He was going to take whatever
they had 2 years of college. So at that time, they're like, hey, you come in as an A1C, all this stuff.
Gotcha.
And so happened, the stars aligned. And we went to basic training at the same time.
Crazy. And your buddy did as well?
Yeah. So all three of us were at MEPS and everything together. Left, went on the bus, got off the bus at the same time.
They chartered a special bus out of Warsaw to take you guys down.
Yeah, they actually pulled my buddy, that's who I thought I was going to basic training with, out.
Okay.
And they put him in another squadron. And my brother and I ended up staying in the same squadron.
And they had no idea.
They had no idea. He's 6'5", blonde hair, blue eyed, right? The kind of the running story in my family is that I was switched at birth. And so we didn't really look alike. We don't really, I don't think, act alike or anything. It's different kind of personalities, very similar, but also different. And so the TI didn't know until, I think it was week 3 or week 4 when we
mail
got mail. Yeah, we got mail.
That's
from
hysterical.
And he's like, why are you getting mail from the same address? Said my brother's, sir, because we're brothers.
And he's just crazy.
It was a fun time.
That is. That's a awesome story of how you brought three people into the Air Force, and your uncle did.
Yeah.
And two crew chiefs, which I agree. There's something about being on an air crew, either a flying crew chief, a load master.
Oh, yeah.
They're just a great
phenomenal
experience.
Jobs.
And phenomenal jobs. And a lot of leadership comes out of those career fields. I noticed when I was down in Peru,
mm-hmm.
that there was so many, we'll call them mid-level leaders that were crew chiefs or flying crew chiefs. And I don't know if it's an additional responsibility or something about traveling with an air crew and having to see small leadership, something like that.
I learned so much at that time. Like I learned a lot about, hey, when you're crewed with someone, how you can treat things differently when you're on the road than when you're
home
station. But I also learned that there was several times where I'd call back home. At that time, you had your phone and you had your calling card. And so I would every once in a while get a hold of my buddies like Chad Pickens or Ben Burdett or those guys. And I would be like, how's college? And they would tell me about these parties and this football.
Chad would talk about,
played in these games and doing this, man, I wish you were here.
How'd you feel about those interactions?
So I was pretty bummed out. There was times where I'm like, man, I'm missing a lot.
Yeah.
These are my bros. These are the dudes that I'll be friends with the rest of my life. And I realized that at 21, I had visited more countries and been more places as a C5 loadmaster than probably my whole hometown combined.
That part, that is probably valid. Isn't that crazy?
And it just, I look at that even now as in Warsaw at the time when I was there, I think it was 12 to 1400 people was it's the size of our wing.
Yeah, you're right.
Like I'm a command chief of a wing that's the size of the hometown that I grew up in.
What an awesome, the C5 doesn't go to bad locations, 4-star hotels. I never that held
people
that
always
works.
Like, people are always like, just we broke all the time. I'm like, I never broke on range. I'll tell you that right now. I never broke in a bad location.
We checked the hotel out before we broke.
I never stayed overnight at Cherry Point, North Carolina. But Hawaii, yes. Aviano, Italy, yes.
Yeah, that must have been awesome. So great stories about you getting into the Air Force and checking back with your buddies that were maybe having it easier than you, and although you twist those experiences to the positive, back to those memories, and there must be phenomenal. So how long were you a crew chief?
I was a load master.
I'm sorry, I knew that.
C5 load, so 96 to 2000 was a load.
And it's a one tour.
Yeah, I thought that I was going to do it for my entire career.
Where was you? Were
Dover.
You run Dover? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So at Missouri to East Coast, a little bit different, but not completely strange.
Yeah, left Warsaw, Missouri in my 93 Grand Am.
Okay.
With a 19-inch TV VCR combo. Thought I was pretty big. And everything I owned could fit in the back seat of that Grand Am with an Atlas. And a set of written instructions on a yellow legal pad on how to get to Dover.
Isn't that crazy?
I got there and forgot to call my mom.
Okay.
And literally, when I called, my mom was like, we were about to call the Red Cross. Like,
we had no idea where you were.
Different time.
Is there a tech school with being a loadmaster or is it all on job?
Yeah, so I didn't really get to Dover until, I think, February to March of 97.
Gotcha.
Yep. Did tech school, so air crew fundamentals, then basic loadmaster school, then SEER.
Yep.
So I went to Air Force Survival School, which is another great experience. And then at that time, you did the Recruiter's Assistance Program.
Gotcha.
So I went back home, wore my blues.
Well, the loadmaster on that airplane must have just been an absolute bear.
Oh.
That airplane people don't realize how much that airplane can carry.
you're telling me about one of your Army lifts that you did and you loaded it.
Oh, it's my check ride.
So I never loaded helicopters before, and they were like, sure, do your check ride. And I had three Chinooks.
And then I show up and they give me this load plan, and I'm like, holy smokes. So then I got to get in the TO. And it really taught me a lot about that standards and discipline, that adhering to a TO. And because I'd never seen a Chinook before. And now I'm going to load one on
three.
Three, and, yeah, right? Three, yeah. But it's, and at that time, because it was my check ride, they're like, hey, A1C Parks from Warsaw, Missouri, you're in charge. So you got to go give the load briefings. You got to go deal with this 06, that this is his three airplanes, that he wants them loaded and they're not meeting the specs of fuel or whatever it may be. And you got to tell him what can and can't go, all this stuff.
And I'm just like,
you rejected a couple of the helicopters, right?
Yeah.
Because they weren't defueled properly.
Yeah.
Was that a conversation with an 06?
Yeah. And after that, I stumbled through it. I was terrible at it. And probably if it would have just been just me there that first time, I don't know that I could have. And I had this Tech Sergeant Duff, Security Forces guy, comes up to me and he was one of the instructors. And he said, listen, here's a little line that would say is load masters. And he said, you don't use it very often, but when you need to, when a colonel or an officer or somebody is flipping out on you, is all you say is, you've confused your rank with my authority on this airplane. And we're going to follow the TO.
Perfect.
That's all we're going to do.
People get killed by following the TO.
So,
and rank does not override the TO at all. So that's awesome.
So I learned so much during that short amount of time.
Isn't it crazy?
Yeah.
Do you have any other awesome or interesting C5 load master stories?
Yeah. So a Mark V boat, which is a Navy SEAL boat designed just to fit on the C5. So it literally barely any kind of clearance, anything like that. It's a boat that, and so we carried the SEALs
such
a lot.
A big boat.
It's massive.
Yeah.
And then.
So it's not these small boat teams that they have. This is like a.
So then I was on a presidential support team. So carried the limos.
Cool.
As well as like White House comm and Secret Service equipment and stuff like that. So when President Clinton was doing his farewell tour to Cape Town, South Africa, all over Europe, stuff like that, it was one of the careers that was dedicated to it. Yeah.
What's the, I'll call it the most austere or difficult position you brought a C5 into? And don't say Whiteman.
No.
I guess that's probably a bad question for a C5.
Sure. No, yeah, because we had to go places that were
paved.
Yeah. So I remember being in Bitburg, Germany one time. And I'm like, are we still the military here?
Yeah.
Is this still military? And it was just people wandering around and
the airfield.
Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
And then probably one of the Egypt or something like that.
Yeah.
Cairo.
I remember doing a stopover in Egypt, and there were a lot of, we'll call it, military members in all black.
Yeah.
Walking around. And I was like, what's
going on there? And
then
there's just some people that were, we always said that they're just on the mill around checklist. Like they're literally just floundering around and you're like, why is that person on an airplane? Why is that?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that too.
Good. Thought you were going to do that for the rest, right?
Yeah.
You loved it.
What turned the corner?
So at the time I was married. I got married while I was out of Dover to a female that was in medical squadron.
Okay.
And so she was a med tech, good load master. As when I would go get over to medical to get my immunization stuff, I found a med tech that I was sweet on. So we got married. She ended up being the AMC Airman of the Year.
Incredible.
And when Connell had the tornado wipe them out, when they were rebuilding, they had first pick, think of it as like a draft of who they wanted to come there. And they chose her to run the medical unit there.
Awesome.
And so she got orders and I was like, hey, cool. I didn't know you had C5s at McConnell. And they're like, no, we don't.
Okay.
And I was like, cool. Can I cross train into being a boom operator? At that time, Loadmaster was a critically manned career field. And so they were like, no.
Nothing.
And so what's my options? And they said, you can stay at Dover.
Okay.
And we'll see if we can't
joint spouse you somehow
at some point, or you can get out.
Wow.
And so I chose to get out.
Yeah. That's poor leverage in my opinion. There's things you could have done at McConnell that would have been perfectly fine.
The crazy thing is then they were, you can get out, and I go to get out and they're like, hey, you're stop lost.
Oh, no shit.
So I can't stay a few extra months anyways. And so we went to McConnell and that was when I first learned about the Air Force Reserve.
So you separated completely and you show up at McConnell with your wife, who's handpicked to start the rebuild of the medical facility there.
Yep.
And you're civilian.
Yeah. So I was selling cars at Davis Moore, which is the largest car dealership in the state of Kansas.
Okay.
Still going on to this day. I went through their school to learn how to sell cars and stuff like that. I always loved vehicles.
Yeah. You love cars. I know that.
started selling cars, was successful at it. And I was just like, I don't like this culture.
Yeah, you're just trying to trick people to spend more money. It's your style.
I never was good at making money at a trade-in because I'm like, hey, if you hold out, they're going to give you more money.
Especially if it was like an older couple or something.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah. That's just not your style, which is interesting. We'll get to another thing that was, interesting that wasn't your thing.
And my wife was like, hey, there's a reserve unit. I was still on, I guess to clarify it, I was on terminal leave.
Okay,
at that time.
Copy that.
And so
you're doing a civilian job, 100%.
Yeah, so about a month into it, I'm like, I'm not sure this is for me. And there's a thing called the reserve. And I dealt with the reserve a little bit with the 512 that's out at Dover.
Okay.
They have a C5 unit out there. So we would mix crew with them. Some of my buddies were over there with them and stuff like that. And so I was like, hey, I'm familiar with the reserve. I didn't know that they had C5s. And they don't, but they have KC-135s.
Yeah.
I went over and talked to them and I said, hey, really, all you have to do is send me to boom school because I've already done SEER. I've already done air crew, basic air crew, all that stuff. They said, yep, we'll send you. And then it kept on postponed. Too late to make a long story short, but just keep going. They got in some legal trouble because of their hiring practices and stuff like that. And so everything was frozen. And so I went back to the recruiter and I said, what job could I do today? What could I start today and get back in the military
right
today? And he said he could be a One Charlie Aviation Resource Major. And he goes, now what they do? And I go, I'm familiar. I was a little master.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love the One Charlies that worked out of Dover. And I said, I'll do it. Yeah. So I enlisted that day. And then they backdated to where I didn't have a break
in service. Okay.
And enlisted and then started the job literally, I think, the following Monday.
No kidding.
And then they hired me as an ART. And I hadn't even went to tech school yet.
So you talk about just walking into a full-time employment opportunity right there. And that wasn't part of your criteria to have an ART position available. No. It was like, I want a job.
Yeah. I want a job. And so did that. Well, it became a GS-7, I think. Well, I think I started as a 6 because I hadn't been to tech school yet.
Okay.
And once I went to tech school.
Yeah, that would make sense.
And so GS-7, at that time I was a senior airman.
Yeah.
So that was 2000 that I did that.
Gotcha. So in the ART world, at McConnell, as a One Charlie, how did you get to Whiteman and how did you convince the wife to come with you?
Crazy story is, at the beginning of 2001, I went to a One Charlie Oscar conference, which was in Colorado Springs. And in the hallway there, I think I was wearing a Kansas City shirt or something.
Okay.
And I ran into Chief Carol Tripp, who was from 30th to the 3rd, and Kathy Welsh, that was a One Charlie over in Ops. And she said, are you from Missouri? Yeah. And where are you at? Connell. And she said, hey, would you ever want to come back home? And I was like, I just got to McConnell. Probably not. And so I just filed it away. And she said, hey, if you ever want to, here's my contact information and whatnot. And she was so friendly and just
inviting.
Yeah. And just say, hey, here's an opportunity. And fast forward, I did that art job a little bit. And then I was like, you know what? My ultimate goal was to become a pilot.
Uh-huh.
At that point. And so I was like, because I'd flown on the C-5, I loved flying. And I was like, I want to get back to flying. In August of 2001, in September 2001, I started school full-time there at Wichita State University.
Yeah.
And then September 11 happened. And September 13th, I went to Istres, France, helped build an air bridge for the airplanes that were coming over.
That's not a One Charlie Oscar duty, by the way. How did that happen? They just said I was so incompetent.
Yeah. So I was the One Charlie that was there for the crews that were coming in to all the refueling planes and everything that were bringing people.
And you're just helping.
Doing One Charlie stuff.
Yeah.
Like making sure orders were up, all that stuff, making sure people were qualified.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rainbow crews and stuff
and
like that. So
it was probably just a frantic mess when they probably didn't have all their ducks in the row. And
nope. So I did a little bit of everything, did security, a little bit of everything.
Multi-ready airman right
so,
there.
So did that. And then when I got back, I was just, my wife at the time said, I'm going to put in for Palace Chase. I'm like, okay, can we do that? And so I was like, yeah. And so in 2002, she did it. So things were looking good for that.
Yeah.
And so I called up Carol and said, hey, I'd be interested in coming back to Missouri. And I think it's either end of 2001 or 2002. I
showed up here. And with your wife.
And she was I showed up here by myself.
Sure.
I was still at McConnell for about the first 8 months. So I lived with my parents in Wichita. And drove up.
And then she came later and she was in her unit.
Yep.
In the medical squadron.
Medical squadron.
Yeah. Phenomenal.
Yep.
Again, another team, family team that comes to our unit. It's not unheard of. In fact, it's not that rare. We have them all over and such. And I didn't perceive that your wife was in her unit until we talked a couple weeks ago. Anyways, in the 303rd,
perfect opportunity for you to become a pilot.
Yeah.
And I saw that. I came in fairly shortly after you got there, and you seemed, we'll say, one of the people that fit our culture. You were competent and maneuvered yourself, whether intentionally or unintentionally, into one of those, I'll call them hot hiring opportunities. One Charlie Oscar, AFE is one of those locations, crew chief, other flight line. You get a lot of contact.
A lot of us
build some confidence because it's difficult to walk into the fighter squadron or any squadron. And I thought you were well on your way to become a pilot. That's why I asked you that question this last week.
Yeah.
Because it didn't make any sense to me.
And so did I.
Now we get to, I'll call it a bad story.
Yeah.
You twist it in as most positive as you can, but I'm disappointed in some of the advice. Yeah. So why don't you talk through that?
Yeah. So 2003, we were joining up to go to Iraq. We're getting activated. I'd enrolled in school full time down at College of the Ozarks.
Down in Branson, Missouri.
So you're just a TR. I'm sorry. Yep. You are a TR, not just a TR.
Yeah, it's TR.
TR is core.
TR.
You gave up your art position.
Yep. Full-time school down there. My wife and I both were using the GI Bill.
Awesome.
But it's hard work university down there. So I ran the airport for them.
Okay.
Because I was coming back to school to have military experience and the rest of these
aviation
college kids that are 18 years old, right? I think I'm 21 or something at the time.
And plus you've been around aviation operations in many different ways.
I hope my knee before we left, once we got activated, jacking around actually with General Nestor
at
the time was probably captain or major. And then when we were in Iraq, really jacked it up good.
Okay.
And so by the time I got back, they did the whole look at it, said, hey, you blew your ACL, got some bone damage and stuff like that. And so I had to go have surgery. Came back from the surgery and I was talking to the flight doc over in the 442nd. He was in the 303rd, actually, I think. And he said, hey, because of you getting the hardware put in your knee and stuff like that, you'll never be able to fly airplanes.
Huh. And, yeah, that's a complete lie.
Yeah.
And
I know that now.
Yeah.
And so it was a time in my life where I'm like, okay, I got to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
So,
and that's someone put a stop sign and it was a false stop sign.
Accepted it.
That surprises me after getting to know you that you would accept that stop sign from that flight surgeon.
Yeah. Looking at all the other things that I didn't accept in my life when people told me no. And I think there was a lot of things. Can we talk about that? Is we talked about, I don't think I was ready to overcome that obstacle at that time. And I think maybe there was other things. We were going through some infertility in our marriage and trying to have some kids and not know success, looking at becoming foster parents.
Right.
There was a lot of other stuff. And I think some of it may have been, I felt pretty selfish, not just being like, hey, this is my career. I want to go do this for
myself. Yeah, I can see that being a factor because you thrash stop signs.
Oh, yeah.
You're thrashing stop signs before this. So this was maybe it vectored you to a place that you maybe didn't think you wanted to go, but I'll tell you what, you're making a huge impact and it's not just here. I know you did it all the way in. Anyways.
So I came back in.
Yeah.
And so when we got back after we got activated for a year, I didn't go back to school and I went back to the art program.
Yeah. That's when I met you.
Yeah. And went back to being an art out here full time.
And I did not know why you weren't pursuing the pilot side. I thought you were pursuing, hey, I want to be the lead One Charlie Oscar.
Yeah.
That's what I perceived as an attached pilot. Anyways, you're an art, which is a coveted job, especially back then. They didn't grow in trees.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of people wanting art positions. I know.
And it was pretty coveted, or it was pretty competitive with the local economy and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was a very difficult job and solid to get. So I understand why you were sitting there. But you decided to leave the art program. I remember this, and it didn't make any total sense to me at the time. Other than you're going to a pretty, honored career field, in my opinion, and hopefully in everybody's opinion, you became a police officer.
Yeah.
And you didn't pick Warsaw.
No.
You picked Kansas City Police Department, which is a legit police department. Yeah.
Third most violent city in the nation at that time.
No kidding. And talk to me about that transition.
Yeah.
And were you waiting for that opportunity or did you just say, I'm changing my mind, boom. Here's the opportunity.
I think to joining the Air Force, at that point up to the Air Force, I thought that my goal was always to be a police officer. And then when I got amazed by airplanes and being in the air and flying and just really caught that bug. And then when I was told no, and I thought that was an end to that. It's funny, as I mentioned him earlier, but Chad Pickens, him and I were talking and he goes, hey, why don't you come do a ride along with me?
So he is a buddy from your football team.
Yeah.
From Warsaw.
Yeah.
That is a KCPD officer.
Yeah.
No
kidding. And him and his brother, both him and John. And he said, why don't you come do a ride along with me? And so I said, okay. We're just like a Friday night or Saturday night in Kansas. He was early.
Quiet.
And he was just, he was like, what do you want to do? What do you want to see? And I'm like, Tom,
I've never seen any drugs before in my life. And he goes, okay. Hey, we're going to come around this corner and there's going to be a guy there and
selling drugs.
He sells crack. He's going to probably take off running. We're going to chase him down. We're going to get the crack from him and you'll be able to see crack cocaine. I'm like, I don't even know what crack cocaine is.
Yeah.
And so I think that night we went to foot chase. We went to a stabbing. We went to a shooting and in a car chase.
Yeah. Friday night in Kansas City.
And I was like, but in the course of all that, there was always somebody that he was helping, whether they wanted it or not. Right? Like whether you go out for this drug thing and then the mom was just like, hey man, this guy's been wreaking havoc. Or the neighbor was, hey, this guy's been wreaking havoc in this neighborhood for years. We're so glad that you're taking him off street or the stabbing or helping someone or whatever. Yeah. And so it rekindled that whole want to be a police officer and go that route and put my name in the hat, went and took the test and got hired.
So what's the turnaround from the ride along to the getting hired?
Less than 6 months.
Wow. Awesome.
Yeah, so, which was pretty unheard of. At the time, people were taking about 2 to 3 years.
I can see that. And I totally respect the police force.
Yeah.
And I get troubled when I see the negativity shown to that group of people. There's bad apples in every place. But
yeah, we got them in the military.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we got, you know, it's just baffling to me that anyone would get there. I've talked to you about how, and this is a segue, talked to you about how whenever I see a veteran with a Vietnam hat, I drop everything and I also thank him personally because of what our country did to those veterans. And I think that's the same angle that the shade is being thrown against police officers. They do nothing but help us and they deserve our respect at the highest levels. The fact that you became a police officer, I would say, intrigued me. And I thought that was an incredible twist or 180 to a very successful career that you've had. And it was neat, in my opinion. I like to hear the stories and stuff like that. Anyways, how long were you a police officer?
I was a police officer for 6 years and just, man, what a growing time for me. I'd never really seen anything. Being from Warsaw, Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
And growing up in a great, strong Christian home that loved me, that never saw any violence, that never saw to going straight into the military where I'd never seen any drugs or really any abuse of any kind or anything like that to go into the streets of Kansas City. It was, again, I talk about traveling was such an educational period for me. So was being on the police department.
Right.
And so was seeing the things that I saw. And it's really, once again, where I would say about every day on the police department, I was scared.
Kidding.
And it was just learning to battle through that and to be successful and knowing that, hey, you may be scared, but that person that's on the other side of that may be scared even more.
Yeah.
And learning that empathy and learning that putting yourself in these victims' situation and being able to help people through that. I learned so much. And then with being able to ride with Chad.
That's phenomenal that you were actually a partner with your buddy from high school.
Yeah. So we were part of the CAN team, so Community Action Network. And so we were.
That's funny. We have the same term in the Air Force now.
So we were CAN officers. And so we went out to all of these neighborhood meetings where they're, hey, we got crime is high, or we got drugs that are high, or we got this is high, or whatever. You know, we went out there and heard their concerns. And then we tried to impact those results.
Yeah.
And then I've got a plaque that I usually hang
on
the wall.
That's another interaction that must have taught you so much.
Yeah. So I got Armor Boulevard is what Armor Boulevard today and what it was when Pickens and I first started there. I've got a plaque on my wall from Hyde Park Neighborhood Association that talks about how successful we were at doing this and impacting.
Yeah, that neighborhood you can tell was in a bad place and now it's actually got a lot of regrowth and stuff like that.
Yeah, one of the commercial apartment complexes that were there in 1 year had 13 homicides inside of the building. And so that was what we were dealing with.
Yeah, crazy.
And so it just taught me so much.
Yeah. Absolutely. You're an awesome driver. So we went up to the airport and we took his old route, 71 up to the city. And it was the smoothest ride I've ever had on that highway. And I noticed it. It's hysterical. And this used to be my area. Yeah. And you just smoothly glide through the traffic and I felt perfectly safe in the car. So no joke. I noticed it. Anyway, so did that for 6 years. I remember asking you specifically why'd you stop being police officer?
Yeah, I don't know if you remember that interaction,
but do you remember what you said?
Yeah.
So why did you stop being a police officer?
So there were several things, right? Is one, the biggest part of it was I felt like I was becoming someone I didn't want my kids to look at and see.
Yeah.
Like I was dealing with the worst of the worst every single day. I used to always say is nobody invites us to a birthday party unless it gets out of hand.
Good point.
When every time I showed up, I use the example of
I was sitting outside of a house one time on a call that it was a 911 call where a neighbor called in and said, hey, I hear some screaming in the house. And so I was sitting out there and I was waiting for another car because my partner was off that day and I hear the person screaming inside.
Yeah.
And so I get on the radio and said, hey, I need that other car, code one, which lights its
nah. Yeah.
I finally get to a point where I'm like, I can't wait.
You got
to
go in.
So I go running in and bust in and there's this male beating this female and there's kids right there screaming. And so I knock this male off. And so I've got him.
So it's physical immediately.
Yeah. So I'm trying to subdue him and I look up and this female has grabbed a knife and she's coming at me.
Coming at you. Okay.
And saying all these things to me. And so now I'm sitting here, I have this individual on the ground and I've got this other individual at gunpoint and I look over and there's two six-year-old kids.
Wow.
And those six-year-old kids tried spitting on me and calling me all kinds of names. And I'm like, I get called here to save someone's life. And that kind of stuff started wearing on me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure I was still helping people, but I knew for a fact that I wasn't the dad I needed to be,
okay.
The husband I needed to be. And I literally walked in. At that time, I was working in street narcotics undercover. That's where I was headed next. And I was doing some work with them and doing undercover stuff. And I walked in and told the major of the epicenter zone and said, quit. And he goes, my partner and I at that time, Chad and I were super effective.
Yeah.
Probably two of the most effective bosses.
Doesn't surprise me at all.
And said, I quit.
Both good and the bad, I'm assuming.
Yeah. And he's, no, you probably just, you need to go see a psychologist. We're going to give you some time off. We're going to. You don't need to quit. And I go, no, I'm quitting. And they said, why are you quitting? And I said, because if given the opportunity, I'm probably not going to take the appropriate steps to be the man that I need to be. And so I was like, this is the only way I can force myself
into this.
And so I quit. I got on the phone and I called my wife. And there's a period of time in there we skipped over is we talked about last time where my wife had passed away.
Yeah, that's
I was a single dad of two kids.
We jumped ahead of that. That's a significant
part
of your life.
At this point, I was in the IRR. So I'm not even in the military. I'm in the IRR, but I'm not participating. And so I just quit the police department and there was something I had prayed about. And I was just like, this is what I have to do. And everyone was talking me out of it. And I was like, this is what I have to do.
Was your buddy Chad talking out of it?
Chad, definitely.
Yeah.
Chad, not talking me out. Chad was like, hey, man, you got to do what's best for your family.
Yeah.
But I want you here. We trusted each other. You put your life on the line with somebody
at
times and you're forever bonded with those members. And so I quit. I walk out. I call my wife and I said, hey, I just quit the police department. She goes,
this was not a family decision.
It was a family decision and she knew that I was struggling with being the person that I felt like I needed to be and who God had called me to be. And I call her and said, hey, I quit. She goes, what are you going to do? And I go, I'm going to have to quit trip and get a sweet tea. She was talking about for work.
Yeah.
Like, what are you going to do for work? And I said, they have allowed me to take all my leave.
Yeah.
So I got a couple of weeks here and then I'm probably going to take a month off. I'll go back to, I had helped run a plumbing company. I'd done several other things. I was like, I'll figure it out.
You'll figure it out.
I'll go work at Home Depot if I have to. But I just knew that I had to quit. So I get this sweet tea and I'm driving home and I'm like, what in the world did I just do? This is a terrible decision. I wonder if I go back there right now, if they would take me back. And so I'm thinking about this and my phone rings and it's Carol Tripp.
No kidding.
Chief Tripp.
The same day, the same
on the hour?
On the drive home
with the sweet tea in my hand. And she says, hey, I'm going to retire. I said, great. When's the retirement? When can I show up? When can I?
Yeah.
That's not what I called. She said,
you didn't even process.
She said,
this was.
Yeah. Not even. So she said, would you be interested in coming back and then taking our job? It's vacant right now. And then possibly fleeting up into my job when it comes open.
Ha.
And I said, it just so happens I have some free time on my hands. Maybe we could get to talk about this. So I think a month later, I was participating in the 303 again.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? I mean, that's one of those things that you just can't not realize. You have to believe that came from somewhere else.
Yeah. So when my wife died, General Bradley called me on the phone and I'd only met General Bradley a couple times. At that time he was the chief Air Force Reserve.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
So he used to be at the 442nd
Wing Commander.
Yep. And he said, hey, you don't probably know who I am or remember me. And I'm like, sir, I'm very familiar with who you are. And he said, I heard you quitting. Cause I'd went in and I told Carol, I said, I can't do this.
Yeah.
I'm overwhelmed. I got two
kind of special needs kids that we just adopted, that, and I'm dealing with grief, and I'm a police officer, yeah, and I'm in the middle of all of that, and it just, I can't do it. And so my enlistment was up, and I said, I'm just going to get out. And Tom Bradley said, son, you probably don't know who I am. And I said, very familiar. And he said, I'm going to ask you to do something. And I said, okay. And he said, I'm going to ask you to reenlist and go in the IRR.
Okay.
And I said,
this is the chief of the Air Force Reserve asking you to stay viable.
Yeah. And I said, why? And I was like, and sir, I don't have the energy to do this. Like, why? And what do I owe? What do I have to do? He said, you don't have to do anything. He said, all you got to do is reenlist. But he said, here's what I think. I think there's going to come a time where you need the Air Force Reserve. But I think more importantly, there's going to come a time where the Air Force Reserve beats you.
Huh.
And he said, I just want you to have that opportunity when that comes around.
Incredible.
And I said, okay.
I know him and Carol know each other. I wonder if Carol had something to do with that phone call.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
100% Chief Tripp.
Yep.
Called him up, Carol, and said, hey, this guy's quitting. Yep. What advice would you get? Or probably probably what would happen is Carol called and was concerned about me. And he was probably checking, and he probably took it upon himself to
make a phone call. That's great. Phenomenal.
Stay tuned for the conclusion of the interview with Chief Parks, where he talks about how his military career led him to the Pentagon and eventually back home to the 442nd.